Okay, so I will give kind of an introduction to 2PI method. Especially for a non-equilibrium. And so, of course, several people are experts and several people are not experts. And so the beginning will be for not experts to indicate what the ideas, what the goals are, and what you would like to do. And then I will, or throughout the talk, I will try to address at least one of the questions that was written on the blackboard 2 days ago, which is the question of precision tests. The other question was about non-abelian gauge theories, but I have nothing to say about that, so I won't say anything about that. But the discussion I give should somehow maybe set the stage for gauge theories. So I will constrict myself to scalars and fermions. But you can judge what we have done with scalars and with fermions, and then you can think about if you want to apply to non-abelian gauge theories and what the problems or prospects are.
I mean, there has been something done, and we'll also schedule another discussion.
For 2PI, and 2PI also. It's not yet on the archive.
There's something in equilibrium.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, but I want to talk about non-equilibrium. So, the motivation is very general. So we want to solve an initial value problem. So at some initial time, let's say maybe a density matrix which specifies the initial state, density matrix, and then plus time evolution determined by the Heisenberg equations of motion, and that should fix everything. And we just want to solve this very general problem. So one way to do is to say, let's develop an effective theory which is valid in some region. So one could say, let's do maybe some kinetic theory, or if you're interested in long wavelength physics, let's do hydrodynamics. But those are, say, effective descriptions which have some range of validity, but what the idea behind the 2PI approach is that you stay as close as possible in as you can in quantum field theory, and you don't develop a theory which should be valid, say, only for long wavelengths and not for short wavelengths, but a theory which is valid as a quantum field theory, so up to the cutoff scale. Without making further restrictions. So we stay in quantum field theory, and similarly we want to be able to apply it far from equilibrium as well as close to equilibrium and also in equilibrium. So we want to have some kind of method which is quite general and can be applied in many different situations within some kind of uniform framework. Of course, this sounds overly ambitious, so there will be some limitations. And this, I will discuss this. And this is related to the precision tests that you can do and see. So you can see what you can do and what you cannot do. But the main difference between, say, other approaches like kinetic theory or dynamics is that you want to be able to describe it without making gradient expansions, without going into long wavelength limit, and also arbitrary far from equilibrium. Okay. So I will discuss, so concerning limitations, one is that I will discuss actually mostly scalar theory. But then, of course, there's also the other limitation of the physics. What physics can be included and what physics is not included. And you can answer this question quite precisely in certain regions of your time evolution.
Physics, you mean strong and weak coupling?
Strong and weak coupling, or whether it has the correct hydrodynamic limit, for instance. Specifically, I'm thinking about transport coefficients. That's a very precise question which you can answer nicely. Okay, this is a very general piece of paper here. not sure if I should say this. So the one big difference with out of equilibrium compared to close to or compared to in equilibrium is that when you compute a time evolution of correlation functions, if there is a dependence on the initial state or initial conditions. And in particular, I mean, if you compute, say, some two-point function defined by the expectation value with respect to some density matrix at time zero, then this will be a function which depends not only on t and t prime, or on the difference between t and t prime, but it will depend also on the difference with the initial time tau naught. And that's the big difference with equilibrium correlation functions, which of course only depend on t minus t prime. And so so this immediately leads to several questions. First question is, so there's memory of the initial state, and the question is, if you wait long enough, whether there's a memory loss of the initial state. That's the kind of the weakest requirement, that the system loses memory of the initial state. A little bit more is that the system equilibrates, meaning that there is some kind of quasi-stationary behavior at late times. And very precisely, very precise question you can ask is whether the system thermalizes in the sense that that endpoint functions will take values. Yes?
So with this initial conditions, in principle, you have a dependence on multi-point functions in those initial conditions.
That's right.
And if you don't, and which is normally done, then you have this equilibration going on from the initial conditions where you go forward or backward in time, which immediately tells you that you're not considering the general.
What do you mean? Well, you have very your initial.
From T0 forward, and you will have equilibration, and you go backward, and you will have equilibration.
That's because this initial state is a very special initial state, which is cooked up by you by specifying the initial conditions.
And that's what you get in time reflection semantic theory. That's how it should be.
Yeah, but the point is that usually when you have, let's say, we have a situation here in Rome, and we go forward,
different than the backward, right?
It's a typical realistic situation. And we start now and go forward in time.
So we are thinking about the error.
But
this is all a question of what sort of initial state
are you starting with? Yes. Even at first order derivative, then you have a really specific point. I mean, just if you take reflection symmetric initial conditions, you have the situation we're talking about. If you don't take time reflection symmetric initial conditions, you don't.
No, I'm saying it's a theory which is very, you know, in practice, it's very restricted. I mean, this is basically, you know, Boltzmann-based theorem, which we have here, which is, you know,
No, it's not implemented at all. No, it's not. No. So you don't break
the initial state where you kill all the higher order correlations.
Why don't we
continue?
Argue about this later.
Okay.
But we don't break, so the equations of motion don't break time reversal symmetry, whereas in Boltzmann equation you do by hand. So that's the difference.
Boltzmann equation would break everything, right?
No. Okay, so but the question of thermalization is a very...
It's a mean field theory.
No, we're not going to do mean field theory.
Wait.
Just wait.
He's showing you that he's not doing mean field theory.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think so far. Actually, I will come to mean field theory pretty quickly.
By the way, mean field theory does not break time reversal.
By mean field theory, I mean that these correlations are always an average.
So there's a difference between the time evolution equations and the initial state that you use. So the time evolution equations you can do, say you can use mean field theory or you can use what I will describe, and they preserve, they are time reversal invariants. They don't have an error of time.
In a general sense.
But the initial conditions are always special in the way that the system will always evolve towards equilibrium starting from that particular initial condition, because it's not a snapshot of a real system. It's something you cooked up, which you say, this is how I prepare my initial state. So it's a very special state. So the language I use is the language of correlation functions. So so very specifically, for this scalar field, I have a two-point function. There is some initial condition specified by the density matrix. So it's a phi density matrix, phi double prime. So this encodes the initial conditions. And then there's the time evolution. And that is since it's from the field theory that is given by a path integral like this, phi x, phi y. So this bit is the evolution. And so since I use this language of correlation functions, there is a whole hierarchy which couples different endpoint functions to each other. So the two-point function is coupled to the four-point function, and the three-point function, and the two and the one-point function is coupled to the three-point function in the case of a, say, a theory with quartic interaction. And so in order to make this manageable, you have to do something about this hierarchy and truncate it, although it's a very general word, this what I mean by truncation. So the simplest way to deal with this hierarchy is to use the mean field approximation. Or also known as a Gaussian approximation, or Hartree, or leading order large n. And they all have in common that you only keep one-point functions and two-point functions. And all higher-point functions are, all connected higher-point functions are put to zero, and so all higher-point functions are expressed in just one and two-point functions. So this is one way to truncate this infinite hierarchy of correlation functions, but this is for this non-equilibrium program is not very well suited because there's no scattering, and so you're not able to describe equilibration and thermalization, and also not memory loss. And so one way to see this is, well, you can see it in many ways. There's no quantum scattering, so it would correspond to a collision-less kinetic equation. Another way to see it is that there are fixed points in the system, non-thermal fixed points, which prevent the system from going away from them and going to this stage. So I won't talk about mean field theory anymore, although it kind of is a helpful way to think about how you're going to truncate the system. So what do I want to talk about instead? So I want to argue that it's useful to consider the dynamics of the two-point function. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. And for instance, one reason is that there's one approach to non-equilibrium physics which we know pretty well, which is the Boltzmann equation. And so the Boltzmann equation describes the evolution of a distribution function. Like this, and there's some scattering, so there's some collision kernel on the right. And this distribution function here is closely related to the two-point function in quantum field theory after making a whole set of approximations. So once you have the two-point function in quantum field theory, you can make first a Wigner transform and then a gradient extension, assume that it has an on-shell form, and this will allow you to write down a kinetic equation for this distribution function. So that's the reason why I want to consider two-point functions, because this will make a natural connection with kinetic theory, and we know that the Boltzmann equation works really well in certain limits where it's applicable. So that is one reason it makes a connection with the Boltzmann equation. The other reason is that I want to consider the dynamics of the two-point function self-consistently. So it's a little bit stronger statement, self-consistently. And the reason for that is that while the system evolves, if it's out of equilibrium, the whole medium will change. So think about if you are in thermal equilibrium, then you have a heat bath, and you may probe this heat bath by computing correlation functions or doing linear response. But the heat bath will always be there. We'll have a fixed temperature, will not change, and so it's a kind of it's a background. Now, if you're far from equilibrium, we don't have a heat bath at a fixed temperature, but you can still think there is some medium present which is evolved, which has, say, something that looks like a temperature, or some energy is distributed over the modes. And when you involve that in time, this medium will change. And so you want to encode this say the change in the medium, put it between quotes. You want to evolve the change in the medium self consistently. And if you think about that it's, say, temperature is encoded in these distribution functions, that's another reason why it's a good idea to study the dynamics of two-point functions, but in a self-consistent way in order to include this evolution of the medium. And so we also want to do quantum field theories. So in quantum field theory, consider the two-point function, so the propagator. And there is an equation for the two-point function, which is the Dyson equation. So d minus 1, d 0 minus 1 minus sigma. And if we want to describe the system self-consistently, the way that is done is by saying, well, let's take, for the self-energy, let's take a self-energy which depends on the full two-point function in a self-consistent way. So when the two-point function changes because of this equation, the self-energy will adapt to that self consistently. And so that will take into account the changing of, say, of the medium or the heat bath when the system evolves. But it's the basic idea. And so how do you formalize that? That is with the help of the 2pi effective action, because that's precisely a functional formulation where the two-point function has, it's an effective action for the two-point function, which is a self-consistent equation. So let me switch to some printed notes. So this is an effective action for the full two-point function. And so just like the 1pi effective action is an effective action technique for the mean field, the 2pi effective action is an effective action for the two-point function as well as the mean field. And so extremizing this effective action will give you equations of motion, which you can then solve. So this is something that is quite old in non-relativistic theory. It was developed by Karnov and Bain. I'll use the notation of Kono, Jakiv, and Tombulis, where the effective action for the mean field, let me just call it phi without brackets, and the two-point function has a specific form, which is like this, classical action plus I over 2 phase log d minus 1 plus I over 2 phase d 0 minus 1 g plus some interaction piece. So I won't go into detail where this comes from, but this is an effective action which you can show it takes this form, which has two quantities appearing here, the full mean field and the two-point function. And this is an action you can vary and will give you equations of motion. So you can vary it with respect to the mean field, gives you an equation for the mean field, and can vary it with respect to the two-point function, it gives you equation for the two-point function. In particular, the equation for the two-point function takes the form of the Dyson equation. So g minus 1 minus g 0 minus 1 plus sigma plus the self energy. So this is a way to quickly arrive at the Dyson equation, but with a specific self energy, only self energy that is determined by varying this thing I haven't specified yet, this thing called gamma 2. So this contribution here. And so this is an effective vacuum technique which will give you a Dyson equation for the two-point function, but in a self-consistent way, because it's the full propagator that appears here. And is derived from an action principle, which means that there are other nice features. So what is this gamma 2? That is actually where everything happens, because this is the part that has to be specified in order to make this a well-defined scheme, or a handle attractable scheme. So this is where the approximation occurs. So this is all, it should in principle contain all two-particle irreducible diagrams. Without external legs, so vacuum diagrams, although we don't necessarily, we're not in vacuum. And so it should, in principle, it should be all 2pi diagrams without external legs, but in practice you will truncate it, and this will then mean a truncation of the 2pi effective action. So why do they have to be 2pi? Well, there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that the self energy is a 1pi diagram, and since it's obtained by varying this gamma 2 bit, which means cutting one line, this structure here has to be 2pi. So for instance, if I have a diagram which is not 2pi, like this one, if I would cut this diagram here, I would cut this diagram here, I would get a self energy like this. And this self energy is not 1pi, so this is not allowed. And the second reason why it should be 2pi is to avoid overcounting, because I use full propagators in this scheme. And if I would, for instance, cut this diagram here, I would get a self energy that looks like this. But this is already included if I use full propagators, because this structure here is obtained by just iterating the equation with this self energy and iterating it over all lines. So that's the reason why it should be 2pi. Okay, so this is pretty general. This is in equilibrium or Euclidean. Doesn't matter. So now I want to specify it to non-equilibrium. And so in non-equilibrium is what I just erased here, where there was a density matrix at some time equals zero, and then there was an evolution, which was a path integral, a Minkowski path integral with the action up there. And so the typical picture that goes with this, of course, is the Schwinger-Keldysh contour. And so we formulate this problem out of equilibrium along this contour in the complex time plane, so this is t. And here at time t equals zero, the initial conditions are applied, and then we evolve forward in time in order to make this a initial value problem with dynamical time evolution. And so the Dyson equation that is written there completely in general is now written along this Schwinger-Keldysh contour. Let's call it sub c. And so as a differential equation, it has the following form. So it's just a free inverse propagator working on the full two-point function. Will be the convolution of the self energy and the full propagator along this contour plus I times delta. And so this is the equivalent to the Dyson equation, but now written as a differential equation. And because we are working in real time, out of equilibrium, this equation is formulated along this contour. Now, you can't solve this equation because it's not yet in a way that you can put on the computer. So I want to arrive at the equations that are then, in practice, solved on the computer. And that is by using some details of the Schwinger-Cowdish formalism, that this complex contour propagator, which is there, can be decomposed into real parts which have a specific meaning. So rather using the language of the contour propagator, G, I want to use the language of two other real functions. Let's call them F and rho. So the G here is a complex function along this contour, and these are two, the real and imaginary components, which have a very specific meaning.
So is that an accent?
No, this is a general form of decomposition. It's the same as saying that, say, you're used to writing the Feynman propagator into G larger with a theta function and G less with a theta function in the other direction. You're saying there's time ordering, but rather than doing that, I prefer to split it in real and imaginary parts.
And it's what signum of X?
This is essentially the sign of the difference of the time, x0 minus y0. It's the difference between these two theta functions. So you could also say, let's decompose it in g bigger and g smaller and write the equations down. Somehow this language is nice because the real and imaginary part of a two-point function have a very distinct meaning. So what is the meaning? There is rho, and this is it's called a spectral function. And this tells you about the spectrum of the theory. So in equilibrium, if you would plot rho for as a function of frequency, it would tell you about the particles in the theory. So there would be, say, a particle here, say, at p squared plus m squared. Maybe another excited state and some continuum. So this information is encoded in the spectral function, but it doesn't say anything about the medium, because the medium is encoded in this other function f of x and y. So this encodes information about the medium in the system that you're looking at. And also this is maybe best seen in equilibrium, because in equilibrium, f and rho are related via something you can give many names. It's the KMS condition, or it's a fluctuation dissipation theorem. But in equilibrium, this f function, or statistical two-point function, is for bosons related to the spectral density in this manner. And so the spectral density encodes the spectrum of the theory, say, and the statistical two-point function tells you about occupation numbers in equilibrium. So out of equilibrium, this generalizes, but that's why these are two distinct components of the general propagator with a very clear different meaning. So in terms of those two components, we can write this general equation along the contour as two separate equations. So these are the equations that are real and causal and which are solved on computers. And so I'm just writing here. So it's real and causal, which means that all the time integrations are now over finite time interval with some self energy here. this is the equation for F, and there's a similar equation for rho. So these are the main equations that appear in all discussions. Yeah, so sigma is also very similar to that distinction there, broken in real and imaginary parts. Yeah, so the delta appears when you split it in real and imaginary parts. Similarly, that the full two-point function obeys an equation, the Feynman propagator obeys an equation which has a delta function on the right, but the Weidman equations obey a homogeneous equation. So in the same way, the delta function appears and it's gone. So sigma is also I'm not there yet left. So sigma is also split in real and imaginary sign components, just to raise a two-point function. Now I'm at the stage where to say what happens with sigma. That's right. Yeah. So these functions here are functions of rho and f. And I haven't yet specified what they are, but they are. So this is but what I want to emphasize is that the structure, you will always get this equation. Up to now, I haven't specified how to specify sigma, but even without it, you will always get this equations, which have to be solved, that these sigmas here depend on rho and f in a self-consistent way. So it's a complicated self-consistent integral differential equation, which describes the dynamics. Well, one further statement before I go to the specification of the sigma. Since this is derived from an action principle, they're all nice properties. And for instance, there is a conserved energy that goes with this equation. Again, independent of the particular truncation that you use, you can write down an expression for the total energy, which takes this form. Time derivatives, phase derivatives, so this is just the quadratic part of the energy. If you write down the Hamiltonian just without interactions and put brackets around it, this is just the quadratic part. And then there is a part due to the interactions, which has to do with the right-hand side of these equations here. So that's 1/4 d3x 0 to x0 d0 dg. And this is written in terms of the self energies, so sigma rho x df dx minus sigma f rho. So independent of the truncation I use, there is a conserved energy that belongs to those equations on the left, and that takes this particular form. That's right, yeah. So this is for the case that phi is equal to 0. You can write it down when phi is not equal to 0. Yeah. But this is important for the numerics, because when you solve these equations numerically, there's all kinds of things go wrong, but you can test whether the total energy is conserved. Okay, so far, this is a general setup, because I haven't specified what sigma is, so this is true for any truncation. Now I have to come to the approximation, and that's the truncation of the 2pi effective action. And so here it's also, again, good to keep in mind that we start from an action principle, so we only truncate. We only write down what is kept for this gamma 2 bit. And actually, I will mostly talk about having no mean field. But once this is given, once you write down what is gamma 2 bit, is in the effect of action, and from this immediately the self energies follow and other quantities follow. And so I only talk about this gamma 2 bit, and then the rest is fixed. So there are a number of ways to do this. One is to do a loop expansion. And so in a scalar theory, or in a theory with cubic and quartic interactions, there is these diagrams, two-loop diagrams, and three-loop diagrams. And so differentiating them once with respect to one of the propagators will give you the self energies that go with it. So this is up to... No, it does. So for instance, if you take this one here, this will give a self energy that looks like this. And so sigma f will be, so in real space, sigma f will be something like f squared minus rho squared, and sigma rho will be something which is of the form f times rho. These all these lines here are full propagators, yeah. And if I split, make the same split in real and imaginary parts for the propagator and the self energy and collect the terms, they will combine in this particular way. So all lines are full propagators, that's why it's completely self-consistent. So this is the loop expansion, and this has been used quite extensively, but only for the following diagrams. So this figure 8 diagram, this diagram, and this diagram. So these diagrams have been used in the numerics. That's right. Now, the reason that these diagrams have been used and not the other ones is a technical reason, namely that when I extract the cell energy, it's easier, yeah? But if I cut one line to get the cell energy, then the cell energies don't have any internal vertices, whereas for these, will always be internal vertices, which makes the numerics harder, obviously. So in every truncation that has been used so far, kind of the technical limitation is that only self energies without internal vertices have been dealt with. I will show numerical results in 3 plus 1. 1 plus 1, 2 plus 1, 3 plus 1. That has been discussed as well, but I will mention that, because I will just mention that it has been dealt with. So renormalization is non-trivial because you have full propagators appearing here, and so you resum certain classes of diagrams to all orders, and other classes are not taken into account at all. So renormalization is different from standard perturbative renormalization, where you go order by order in the loop expansion. Oh, that is something else. The fact that there's maybe triviality or so, that's a different problem. But just to read...
At some point, if you get close enough, good enough approximation...
You should see that, probably, yeah.
Yeah. So I was just interested in actually...
Yeah. So what has been done is renormalization in the sense that those equations are finite. So there's no cutoff dependence when you solve them. Well, you have to apply counter terms and pick up
the thing. Of triviality in a scalar theory. Yeah. So you cannot send the cutoff to infinity, but you can do what people call perturbative renormalization.
You then are saying totally different things. You say they're finite, and you renormalize them, the whole order. You're saying you need to keep a cutoff.
Well, you absorb the cutoff dependence in counter terms.
Consistently. For the solution of the equation.
Yes.
That was in charge.
trivial.
No, but heading,
I mean, this is a scalar field theory.
I know it's a trivial.
It's trivial. And if you set the cutoff to infinity,
we have a general correct conclusion supported by non-degenerative lattice results, but I don't know of any, say, further conclusion.
So he's.
It's a not obvious to me that the is a trivial issue.
It's not trivial.
But it has been worked out in the same sense as perturbative realization of a scalar field theory or the Higgs sector of the sum of more or less.
Yeah, but here you're summing to all orders in sum of approximation. If I do that in one loop,
so that's more complicated.
I get the lambda ball. And that is a real sickness of the solution. In other words, I get polar the momentum. Right? And how do you avoid that? Or do you not avoid that?
Or do you keep a cutoff in there?
Yeah.
You always keep a cutoff in there, but you can do the equivalent of a perturbation, which limits your sensitivity to the cutoff logarithmic run here.
But it gives you a
logarithmic running will always be there in 3+1 dimension.
Gives you a singularity, right?
But that's a property of the theory. You could choose other theories.
I'm just trying to understand properties are
there are two different questions. One is how to introduce counter terms and whether they're really of the same form as the perturbative situation. And the second question is what do you do with the cutoff, I think, which is what you're asking. Yeah.
Now, and do you see
the lambda pole?
The way that works is that you restrict yourself to initial conditions which are slowly varying with respect to some cutoff, and then the theory is essentially insensitive to the cutoff with reasonable initial conditions.
There's still a regime where you...
There's a regime in which the corrections are power law corrections in the k squared over the cutoff squared, and for weak enough coupling, that's under control. But you can't take the cutoff literally to infinity.
Yeah. Now, of course, in the end, for the purposes of the physics, if you want to get to, you're discussing a much harder theory. One that might not have a lambda fault, but which has gauge invariance issues with regularization.
So I started out before you were here. I started out by saying that there were two questions raised in the beginning. One was how does this formalism work, and what are precision tests, and so on. The second then is to apply it to non-abelian gauge theory, and I will not say anything about the second issue. It's work in progress. It's work in progress.
They're really hard to imagine. There are a lot of problems with four identities.
No,
well, it's extremely hard to imagine because 2.1 to 2.1 are all
related.
The other issue I'm wondering is whether there's you're going to discuss other computations.
Yeah, I'm going to talk only about scalar theories and fermions. And so this is the loop expansion, then there is the OM model.
Can I still ask about renormalization? Because in standard renormalization, you renormalize masses and coupling constants. And here you have an issue of densities. And let's say there's a real particle and there are virtual particles.
Well, we don't make a distinction really between real and virtual particles. We just have 2-point functions, 4-point functions.
No, you state the same renormalization conditions as you do it perturbatively. So you know what are the relevant and marginal operators in your system, and even though this is a theory that has composite operators, we know how to deal with renormalization theories with composite operators. You just take your favorite textbook, and actually if you follow that rules, you will also find taking those diagrams self-consistently, so with full propagators, it turns out this is exactly what you have to do.
Okay.
Remove the cutoff dependence up to logarithmic corrections in 3+1. It will show, for instance, 1+1, where you can renormalize the theory, and there it's all finite.
Okay, I just mentioned on setup because the reason why I have doubts is because if in standard renormalization you go to asymptotic states and you have operator for asymptotic states, here if you go to a dense medium.
It's the same.
There's a very limited way of thinking about renormalization. You said when you say you go to asymptotic states, you can define your physical quantities for your relevant and marginal operators. If you state physical quantities which you get from an experimentalist if you would have a real theory, mm-hmm. and you fix these numbers for the relevant and marginal operators, then your theory is renormalized.
It's the same as in thermal field theory, where you don't consider in and out states or asymptotic states, because you always have a heat bath and particles scatter. But it's not a problem. You still, the ultraviolet bit can still be renormalized.
Short distance behavior, the theory should have nothing to do with the medium.
Yeah.
And that you can show explicitly that the renormalization for these subjects.
Renormalization of the
so,
are you going to talk more about initial conditions?
Not really, but I can mention it when I show some results.
Can you just say a word? I mean, how do you feed in initial conditions? And what if I want some initial condition which is non Gaussian density metrics?
Let me first discuss the truncations and then I'll come to the conditions. So the other model is the OM model and the 1 over N extension. And so in this case, you have a whole series of loops, of bubbles like this, of classes, but of course those are resolved by introducing an auxiliary field. So this is an auxiliary field. And so that one has a self-energy as well, and so this will take care of resolving this whole chain of bubbles here, this is a correlator. And again, this is now there's only one diagram here, and this diagram has the same features as those, namely that there are no internal vertices. So that can be done in exactly the same way. And then there is a Yukawa-type model has been discussed by Jürgen and by other people, where you have a fermion loop with a scalar field like this. And again, it has the same feature that you can solve it like this. So those are the ones that have been done in 3+1 dimensions. I have worked on going beyond this by including, let me look at the figures, by including the first diagrams that appear at the next order, which is this diagram and this diagram. So this is so-called next to leading order in 1 over n. This will be next to leading order. And we have implemented these equations in the case of zero dimensions, so quantum mechanics, which is now there are two internal vertices, so it's more work. So that's why we haven't done field theory yet. But just to indicate that we are working on going beyond what has been done. But the feature of all things that have been done in great detail is these, the fact that these self-energies have no internal vertices. In these?
Yes.
It's 3+1.
And also 1+1.
And also 1+1. You insist. Well, we started in 1+1.
Nice. Looks more like UCD than these.
Yeah, trying to
penalize
with 1+1 with a Boltzmann equation. In 1+1, a Boltzmann equation is 2-2 scattering. We do nothing. Incoming and outcoming momenta are the same. So getting a thermal equilibrium in 1+1 is harder. So it was a very good test to see that it really thermalizes these approximations.
1+1.
Which? 5-4. It's 5-4.
4+1. You just have 2-2 in both.
Not with, not the fermions.
You should do it.
It was done with the fermions.
No, the fermions were 3+1.
It was 3+1.
Okay, so this now specifies the truncation. So now now those equations on the left are completely specified in terms of self energies, and so they can be solved. So what are the initial conditions that you need to supply in order to do this? Well, there are those two-point functions that need to be given, first of all. And so this F two-point function, if I... we always consider systems which are homogeneous in space, so translation invariant in space. So the two-point function takes depends on the spatial momentum and t and t prime. So it's not translation invariant in time because it's non-equilibrium, but it's still translation invariant in space. So it's a homogeneous system. So for here we have to specify initial conditions, and there are actually three of them. There is f at time zero. There is a time derivative of f. And there is a second time derivative of f, all at t equals t prime is equal to zero. And physically, what you specify here, if you go back to this equilibrium relation, if you can think about specifying the number of particles in the initial mode. That information is supplied by specifying the initial conditions of this quantity F. And then there is the spectral density, where the spectral density is a commutator, if you look at closely at the field theory. And so this is completely fixed by the commutation relations. So in other words, the spectral density is the expectation value of the commutator of two fields. And so at equal time, it vanishes, and the first time derivative is equal to 1, because of the commutation relation. This is, if you use Gaussian initial conditions, where you only specify two-point functions, you can also specify higher correlations, and these would appear as sources at time 0. Jürgen, you want to say something more? I haven't worked on that. But
maybe one should say that Pavel also had another implementation. What he did was to think about the initial state being built up by some running along the imaginary time contour, which is another possibility. There are different possibilities to put in initial correlations. One is sources at time 0, or running so whatever builds up your initial four-point function, you want to have the expectation value over, you know, four powers of the field, and you put in on the right-hand side whatever you need initially to get initially such a four-point function.
Something coupled with
five. Well, in that equation, it would be a source. It would be like this. It appears as an inhomogeneous term, right?
In those equations,
yeah. Acting only at time 0. Only acting at time 0.
So even in your Gaussian description, in your discussion of F, you say I'm really putting in three functions, 0, first, and second time derivatives.
No, it's not second.
It's mixed.
First, mixed. That's the always second partial differential equations. Yeah.
I can explain why it is. And
So that's more than just your number density.
More than just a number density. In fact, if you look back in the old papers of Amil, he will specify precisely what those three initial conditions are. Well, so you can specify in terms of mixed states and pure states and dispersions of the field and the momenta. So those are the independent quantities. So the reason why you need three is that if you solve your system in T and T prime, so two-point functions depend on T and T prime, you discretize it in time like this, so you want to know all this information, you're not involving it in one direction, like in a normal differential equation where you would specify two initial conditions, but you want to go forward in this direction, but also in this direction. So what you specify is 1, 2, 3 initial conditions, and this one is related by time symmetry, and with those three initial conditions you can propagate forward in all directions. So that's the reason why you need three rather than two. Okay, so now I can show some results.
Is there a reason why you consider homogeneous in space initial conditions?
The simple answer is that it's technically simpler.
What he's asking is whether evolution will develop in homogeneity.
No, so there's a difference between thinking of a system which is homogeneous and an expectation value which is only depends on time, on space, on momentum. So we always compute the evolution of expectation value, so the ensemble average. So what happens inside is a lot of inhomogeneous scattering going on, but in the end, the expectation value itself will be translating invariant in space. And so it describes all the physics. I will show you. It contains all the physics relevant for scattering and thermalization. But you may want to describe systems which are not spatially homogeneous, like maybe both Einstein condensate in a trap, for instance. Then you would need to go beyond this. But for the fundamental physics of thermalization, you don't need to do that.
Okay, can I just ask before you show is there any example of a relativistic calculation that has been compared to this one?
No, I don't think so. We've done detailed comparison with
it's funny that you say relativistic. So we implemented this in non-relativistic to calculate dynamics of cold quantum gases.
Yeah.
That was, to a certain extent.
There have been quite a few. I mean, this lots of them.
No, actually, most of them just use Gross-Kodayevsky equation. Most of them use just Gross-Kodayevsky equation, yeah. Which is not enough to
find the answers.
Okay, so let me show you some results. These, most of the results are rather old because they are from when we started, when Jürgen and I show mostly results from Jürgen and me, which are a few years old. So many of them have been done in 3+1. I show results in 1+1 mostly, and maybe have been done on bigger numerical systems, so the curves look nicer and so on. But the flavor of the results is represented in these early figures. And so now we solve those integral differential equations, discretize them on a lattice, and then solve them as they are. It's numerically it's non-trivial because you have this whole memory kernel here, so you have to keep track of the paths in order to do the updates, but you can do that. And so this is a first result by Jürgen and another Jürgen, and it's very faint, but it's dated and it's fainted in time. but this for me this was very convincing that this was a very promising method. So what is shown here is two-point functions, equal time two-point functions, time for different momentum modes p as a function of time. Why switch off this light? The term must be more light. No, these are for here. I've already switched those off.
But this, you already you were successful in coupling them.
Yeah, but there's only one button there.
But there are three over there, right?
Yeah, good button. So what is shown here is the time evolution of equal time two-point function, so say phi time t. It's a function of time for three different set of initial conditions, and then for three different momentum modes p. And these different initial conditions are chosen such that the total energy density of those three systems is exactly the same. Meaning that if the system would forget about where it comes from and only remembers some global quantities like total energy, after some time, if the system would equilibrate and thermalize, it would forget the knowledge of the initial conditions, but thermalize, equilibrate to the same values in the three different cases because they have the same energy density. And so that's what you see here. Here are the three curves for one particular momentum mode. It's very hard to see. Yeah. But, I don't know if I can do something, but no. But so there's one going here, and one going here. And so initially they're very different, they evolve in a different way, but at late times they come together and they reach the same final value.
So the magnitude of these times are in some units of?
They're in units of the elementary mass in the problem, I guess.
Inverse mass.
Yeah. It's a long time. Scalar fields take very long to thermalize.
It's 1+1.
It's 1+1 also. But generically, scalar fields take.
It's all off-shell effects. That make
it. It depends also on the size of the coupling, of course. If you crank up the coupling, it would go faster.
So,
but the I is a 1, then, for example.
So you see, it's order 1. It's not just the coupling that goes in, it's also
right.
The energy density.
Right.
You know, it's
some
lambda times temperature that is really relevant if you go to high temperature. Right. So you should ask for that. I think it was order 10, as far as I remember. So it's certainly most you can do for a Lubin's transfer.
But lambda has dimensions here.
Lambda has dimensions as well.
It's mass squared over temperature.
Actually, the best way to see how big the coupling is. The best way to see how big the coupling is to look at the spectral density, and I'll show a plot later, and see whether the width of the quasi-particle is narrow or whether it's broad. That will give you an insight in whether it's a weakly coupled system or not.
Are there any other concerned quantities besides inner changes, is the total momentum?
No. For instance, also, it's a scalar. We don't have chemical potential.
But the form of the
well, that would be zero.
If it was not flux, because it's homogeneous.
It's homogeneous. Yeah. So those would all be zero.
So this is the first
one momentum mode where all three come together. This is another momentum mode where you can hardly see them, but they come together, and this is the third one. So this indicates independence of initial conditions at late time and only depends on total energy density.
What you can't see really because it's so faint, even though they start very differently, even before they reach thermal equilibrium, the slope, if you just consider the first three upper lines, the slope is almost universal. So there is a region of rather universal evolution after a very short time, which is, when you compare it, when you compute it, just the standard relaxation time. So if you compute the standard relaxation time approximation, that's the time where you lose the details about the initial conditions, and then the evolution is rather universal. But it takes a very long time, much larger than standard relaxation times, to thermalize the system.
Can you that's universal just
so the standard relaxation time
appears defacing, though. It's not.
No, it's more. It's the imaginary part of the sub-energy that gives you the time after which the details of the initial conditions got lost, but then you're still far from equilibrium. So standard equilibration time estimates would grossly fail to give this standardization time. It would be much too short.
They do give the time where it itself becomes original.
Yes.
But you see, the universal thing is something else.
Yeah, thermalization takes much longer.
So the relaxation towards the final state is what you're describing.
If you let me bring a response, if you're very close to equilibrium, these two time scales, so loss of the initial conditions and going to thermal equilibrium, they collapse to one time scale. But then you need to be arbitrarily close to equilibrium. Then you don't have the separation of scales.
Let me show them the.
Let you say this is 1 plus 1 second feature effect.
So we did the same in 3 plus 1 and with fermions. We always found this characteristic feature that the details about the initial conditions get lost on time scales of relaxation time approximation. And then you have a very long evolution towards thermal equilibrium if you don't start arbitrarily close.
Well, this in some if I come to the end of the talk in 2 hours or so, you see that essentially these methods describe weakly coupled physics. Although you may crank up the coupling, they don't describe Rick physics. Besides that,
yeah. Okay, but when you say different initial conditions here, what do you mean?
I mean,
the framework
is that this f, these f and its time derivatives, these only things that have to be specified in this Green function, those have different values.
So, for instance, one which shows that was almost thermal, the other one which shows, you know, randomly distributed, just wild, and another one was, you know, peak at some characteristic point.
But there is an expression for the energy, so you can tune a few of these modes. So that the total energy is.
But they're
very different. I will show. I'll show the next plot now. So first, this actually. So this is a not so faint figure. So this is, for instance, now we specify these, and in terms of an initial particle number, n, as a function of momentum, and the thermal one. So this would be bosons. Bose-Einstein distribution would be something that looks like this. But instead, we specify it with some characteristic shape here, so that I'm way too many modes with momentum around here and not enough modes with momentum around here. So this is a far from equilibrium distribution function which should evolve from this peak to this peak as time goes on. So let me show that result. So this is the same plot as on the first slide. This is the equal time two-point function for different momentum modes, so roughly the particle number distribution as a function of time. And so the five different momentum modes, so this is the zero momentum mode and then higher and higher momentum. If you remember, some of these modes, these ones had a too high occupation number So those are the ones that start out too high here. And what they do in time is that they come down and take their right place where they belong in the Bose-Einstein distribution. Whereas the infrared mode, zero mode, and another mode here are too low, and they come up and take a higher place here. And so what you see here is this occupation numbers exchange in such a way that in the final end they are ordered correctly according to momentum, but actually you can say something more precise, but I don't have a figure of it, of this, if actually the way they are distributed here is according to the Bose-Einstein distribution. So you can read off the temperature from these final asymptotic values.
So the occupation is compared to one in how large when you start? Compared to one in Bose-Einstein occupation?
The occupation here is pretty high, so that it's all classical. It's very close to classical. So the occupation numbers are quite high here.
In those modes,
yeah.
Because if they're high, they're actually what you should get. I mean, at least inside, you know, they're high enough, you should get a the system should start to condense and finite momentum, and then this indeed, you should have like a tsunami. Collapsing onto zero momentum.
Yes.
With a possible cause of discontinuity in momentum distribution.
Okay, I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's what you see here, but this curve evolves like this. So now there's another precision test. So because there's not just one curve shown here, there are three curves shown here. So very quickly, let me say how those are obtained. You can also implement a 2PI approach in a classical statistical field theory, because it just tells you about how you truncate fluctuations and correlation functions. In a classical statistical field theory, you have correlations and correlation functions, and so you can do the same trick and apply a 2PI formalism and write down exactly the same equations which are on the left there, but now for a classical statistical field theory. And in practice, what it means is that if you have a self-energy written here for the quantum case, and if you would restore h-bars and so on and put h-bar to zero, you will find that all what happens in the classical case is that some terms are dropped in the self-energy. So the classical self-energy that corresponds to this one has this term absent, and the classical self-energy that corresponds to this one has this one absent. And so you can straightforwardly also implement it in a classical statistical field theory. But moreover, in classical field theory, you can just find the exact numerical solution just by integrating equations of motion and sampling initial conditions from this probability distribution that gives you these Gaussian correlation functions. So that is what's called the exact solution, sampling of initial conditions and solving equations of motion and then reconstructing your ensemble average. And so those are the two other lines here. The black one is 2PI classical, and the blue one is this exact result obtained by sampling initial conditions and evolving in time. 1 over n, this is in this 1 over n expansion in the ON model to next to leading order.
So I can't really tell from just looking at this whether the difference between the quantum and classical is larger or smaller than the error that you make in your two treatments of the classical system.
That's right. It's difficult to see, but there's a next block where it will be.
So these modes are chosen such that you do not expect quantum corrections to be important. So these are the highly occupied modes, deliberately chosen. And if you just, dropping these terms, rho squared compared to f squared, you can translate into more conventional particle numbers, and it means particle number larger than 1.
Right.
And these are the modes with particle numbers larger than 1. Therefore, you don't see a difference.
Yeah, so otherwise you...
Modes, of course, you see a difference.
Yeah, otherwise you would see this one different from those two.
Because you wouldn't get a Bose-Einstein distribution from a classical distribution.
Yes. But, so the qualitative, quantitative features are very good here. There's some deviation at some point, you don't really know where it comes from, but the thing to emphasize is that we start very far from equilibrium here. There's lots of things going on, and we are essentially in equilibrium here, and for this entire time interval, this method seems to work. That's the thing you can read off.
I can read correctly those. The deviations, they are small, but they are rather between the Monte Carlo and the 2PI results. So the 2PI results are to be there, but the Monte Carlo.
Yeah, I guess you're right in the sense that here this one seems to deviate from those two, and here as well. So this can be done more precisely by looking at the unequal time two-point function. So now we're not looking at equal time, but we're looking at unequal time. So phi at time t with phi at time 0, that's a function of time. And what you expect here is a damped cosine, because this is, say, that's what you expect. So it's just a mass and a width, and in real time this corresponds to a damped oscillating function. And so this is purely classical. So the 2pi method and the exact numerical result, and this is for different values of n in the 1 over n expansion, n equal 2, 10, 20. And so for n equal 2, you see some difference here. For n equal 10, you see a smaller difference and maybe some bigger difference in the end. And for n equal 10, 20, these curves essentially fall on top of each other. N equal infinity is boring. That's mean field theory, and in n equals infinity there's no damping in this unequal time. And that's what you should see in the next plot. So if I fit those damped oscillations to a cosine and a damping factor, which is the width, then you can plot the width as a function of 1 over n. N equals infinity is mean field or leading order large n, where nothing happens, so the width is 0. But for finite n, you have a non-zero width, and the width also decreases when n increases. And now you can compare. So this, I should say, this is in a run where the energy density is less. So the quantum dynamics is different from the classical dynamics, in contrast to the sheet 2 pages ago.
Can you go back to the previous plot for just a second? So in the n equals 20 result, on that first dip, is 1 to 10 and 1, put yourself on the first minimum. Right there. What are those two curves?
10 and 20.
That's 10 and 20?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, they're 10 and 20.
Yeah.
They're not a difference between the two methods.
Good. Thank you. You're what, halfway through, a third of the way through?
Yeah, I would like to say something about transport, but...
And I'd like to hear it. I'm just wondering whether we should actually...
Yeah, there's one more numerical plot, but that's very quick. So here you see now this is a 1 over n expansion, so it should work better for large n, so better for small 1 over n. And you should compare the classical 2pi with the Monte Carlo, because those are for the same system. So for n equals 2, they're quite apart, which is not unexpected, because n is 2 and we do 1 over n expansion. For n equals 4, they're closer, and if you increase n, they become closer and closer. So there seems a convergence with 1 over n in the way that you expect it, because it's 1 over n expansion. The energy density is so low that quantum and classical are different, so this is the damping rate for the quantum system. And so for this, in this regime, you should not apply classical physics if you want to approximate the quantum dynamics.
The surprising thing is that the quantum seems exactly half
That's a coincidence. But what is remarkable is that the quantum system remembers the information about the initial state longer.
That's right. Mm. The damping is smaller.
That's remarkable, because you don't really naively, afterwards I was able to talk myself into both viewpoints, but that the quantum system remembers the initial state longer is an interesting thing.
And it's independent of the initial conditions?
Rather independent of the initial conditions. I saw that many times.
Okay, I want to show two more quick results to indicate that it's not kinetic theory. So this is the distribution function as a function of time. You can define a quasi-particle distribution function by doing a Wigner transform of the two-point function and assume that there is a quasi-particle form of the two-point function and then extract a distribution function. And this changes in time because it's non-equilibrium, so there's a time dependence here. And so initially there was this peaked form, this what Pisarsky actually called the tsunami, but then as time goes on, this peak comes down and the infrared modes become more occupied, so that the final result will go towards the Bose-Einstein distribution here. And so there's lots of things happening in the particle distribution function, so it's far from equilibrium, but there's also a very fast moving around. But in contrast, if you look at the spectral density, which is shown here, so this is now the spectral density as a function of energy for for different times in the system. So again, this is a Wigner transform, so this is the mean time as time goes on. The spectral density is changing, but it's changing very slowly. So this is a slow variable, whereas the other one is a fast variable, which would motivate that you could use kinetic theory. But on the other hand, there is a certain non-zero width here, so you would not automatically approximate the spectral density here with an on-shell delta function, because there is some width here, and the width is changing very slowly while the system is evolving. Although, for instance, the position of the peak, which is plotted in this plot, initially, of course, everything is changing, but very rapidly the peak stays at this position, so the quasi-particle properties are very quickly established in this system. But we don't, it's not put in, it's solved self-consistently by those equations, and both distribution numbers and quasi-particle properties are solved self-consistently.
How do you interpret the width?
The width is because there is collisional scattering in the medium that gives the width.
The width gives you the time after which you lose the details about the initial condition. It's the characteristic time at which your two-point function goes to zero.
This is 1 plus 1 still.
So. It's still 1 plus 1, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Can we go back and read this one?
So this looks the same as on the next sheet, but as a coincidence. So this is the distribution function. That's a function of
as a function
for
as time evolves.
So these big egg knots are the kind of the mean time where you are. It's actually in that language t plus t prime over 2. So this plot is completely has essentially the same information as this plot. So what is shown here is a few momentum modes which evolve in time, and the other plot has all momentum modes, but for all momentum modes or energy modes, but for a few time, for a few snapshots. So the ones that are diving down are the ones that are here, and the ones that are coming.
So this doesn't settle down until about 100.
It's a different publication, this one. So although it's not the same numeric, it's not the same run. It was a different paper, so I actually don't remember how closely related these. No, it's the same. It's the same qualitative feature, but the time scales. I don't remember whether the coupling constant was the same, for instance. And the other one was 1 over n. This was a three-loop approximation. So it's different theories, actually, also.
Yeah, but this didn't matter.
But it doesn't matter. It's the same qualitative feature, but if you would look at the time scales and details.
I think it's even here we use the initial time mass, and in the other one we use
some details
the thermal mass.
But the qualitative feature is. Okay, so those were the numerical results I wanted to. So I should say there have been much more numerical results in 3 plus 1, fermions, bosons.
The message is that you have very rapid change in the nature of the quasi particles, and then somehow very long combination of those.
Well, not the nature of the quasi particles. Those are actually
in the energy.
In the occupation numbers. There's very rapid change.
If you ask what was the biggest outcome for me from this, it was that if you use standard relaxation time approximation, so for instance, if you look for estimates, what is the thermalization time that you get for the Bohr-Luhmann plasma people using bottom-up,
for this theory, what do you mean by a standard relaxation time approximation?
The time scale that you get from the imaginary part of your cell energy.
In thermal equilibrium?
In thermal equilibrium for real times, there is a relaxation time that is typically identified as the thermalization time. And it's true if you take an initial condition where you just kick out one node, a big part of equilibrium.
So you're literally in the quasi-particle width in equilibrium?
Yes. Right. It's the width of this spectral function then, in equilibrium. That this time scale says nothing about the thermalization. If you have
it's not a bad estimate of the
time
it takes to forget the initial condition.
It's a good estimate of the time to forget the initial condition.
To forget part of the initial condition.
Right.
And there were still issues like the overall amplitude, the distribution, remembering specifically.
You can be far from Bose-Einstein after this relaxation time, and then you evolve in a rather universal way towards thermal equilibrium on much larger lengths, on much larger timescales.
Is this description in terms of bare particles or dressed particles?
There are no particles of
air. So the Green's functions are, the fields are the bare fields.
There is no bare
field. But you start with normalized fields.
Yeah, yeah. They're the renormalized fields. We don't even then he showed
evolve those fields from some starting value, and there is no self energy when you start.
I mean, there is a, for instance,
for these particular runs, we start with Gaussian initial conditions. So you would say there's no self energy when you start.
There's a tadpole.
There's, of course, there is a tadpole. Self mass correction is always, we always have the tadpole.
The reason that he showed particle numbers was just to compare with Boltzmann type language, where people want to have a particle number.
By the way, you say non-kinetic theory. Was this ever run with
well, this is in 1 plus 1. This 1 plus 1 kinetic theory doesn't, the simplest Boltzmann equation doesn't work, because 2 to 2, if you just have 2 to 2 scattering and 5 fourths, it's momentum and energy is conserved in a collision.
But in 3 plus 1.
Well, there have been comparisons, yes. So there have been, I think Jürgen did comparisons, but there was also a paper by Müller and Lindner where they compare dynamics of 2pi dynamics with Boltzmann equations. And they agree when they can agree, and they disagree when they strictly cannot agree, because they use. So the Boltzmann. If you use a Boltzmann equation which conserves particle number, for instance, then a collision kernel which conserves particle number, but particle change number changing processes are important, then it doesn't agree because the Boltzmann equation doesn't have that freedom.
Well, you should take a collision kernel which corresponds to the same diagrams that you use in the 2pi.
If you do that, you find that the earliest time scale where they can agree is after this relaxation time, is after this width of the spectral function that's given by the width of the spectral function. And the reason is that the Boltzmann equation does not only assume a gradient expansion and a quasi-particle picture, it also assumes a loss of initial correlation. Mm-hmm. Any derivation of the Boltzmann equation uses a loss of initial correlations, and that's exactly the time for the loss of the initial correlations.
But I don't understand you're saying that they can agree. Do they agree? Or
for weak enough couplings.
Well, what about this larger time correlation?
Yeah, I mean, there are graphs in these papers of direct comparison of different initial conditions.
Yes.
And what, can you summarize, what's the statement? For what kinds of initial states, for what kinds of coupling do they agree at what time?
So you find strong disagreement at early times, meaning times shorter than what is given by the equilibrium spectral function of that system, the width.
That's not surprising.
That's not surprising. You find at later times, for those approximations where the Boltzmann equation conveys the same symmetries as the quantum field theoretical description, you find, I would say, very good agreement at late times.
But
you see, there were some papers on the web that showed the comparison of the quantum field theoretical description and one with 2-to-2 scattering, and 2-to-2 conserves particle number. So of course the Boltzmann equation gives you a chemical potential even in situations where there isn't. And these people created huge differences between these quantum descriptions and Boltzmann, and made a big noise about it. But it is, of course, they're obvious that by choosing a certain initial state, you can generate as large differences in the end as you like. Would you go to more sophisticated Boltzmann equations, including particle number changing processes? Of course, those very bad results would improve in favor of the Boltzmann equation.
And the only fair thing to do is to compare.
Taking a two-loop diagram is just 2-to-2 scattering on Boltzmann level.
Yeah.
But the two-loop diagram has also 1, 2, 3. It has these off-shell processes,
right,
which have particle number changing processes.
But if you just keep this diagram in your 2pi approximation, then the standard Boltzmann kernel that belongs to this, it's just this point scattering to two. But in 2PI, with self-consistent propagators, you have much more processes.
Yes. So you have one option. You can get option effects. And so as you say, you have to use
same. So you have to be more. You have to be quite sophisticated to say what kernel in the Boltzmann equation you have to use in order to capture not only the lowest order scattering but also the off-shell effects, which lead to particle number changing processes.
So you cannot just take the same off.
So you cannot say
that for Boltzmann.
Yes. So I have a question. I want to rephrase the question regarding dressed and pair and the initial issue of the initial condition. If you were to density to occupations which are close to zero, then the system is of very low density, and if the system were of real particles, it shouldn't evolve, right? Would your system evolve, and then on what time scale?
Yeah, because we always have the vacuum fluctuations present.
So even though the occupation number will be zero,
that's still the one half is there. So those modes are evolving.
So you would have bare particles in dress, basically.
Well, I don't know what that language means.
It's done with the time translation invariant initial condition. I think that's what you are asking about, right?
If time translation is...
Then it should not evolve.
Nothing.
Yeah, but if you would really be in a ground state.
But what you have shown here, is not.
No, we're not.
I mean, you're not feeding in a description that's an exact eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, right? You can feed in something which is time reflection symmetric, mm-hmm. and you should still see initial transients.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's one of the time scales, presumably. Yeah. It must be as a time scale there. There is a trend, I mean, they dress over a certain period of time.
But that is that initial short time scale.
I think it's so.
Well, they dress.
I'm not quite sure.
The physical particle mass.
Yes.
Yeah, the mass, but it can also be dressed by the width in some sense, because...
But so like, if I go very small energy, then the widths are going to be negligible.
They're going to be very small, yeah.
So you see something, people call this sometimes also defacing time. You know, very rapid evolution, it's on the order of 1 over mass scale, dressed mass scale. This is, on these plots you've seen, this is just on the axis, if you like. It's so quick. It's not like switching on
what
effects.
What values of lambda over m squared have we been looking at? Trust us.
It's something up to 30, I guess, something like that. Yeah, but it's the interaction was lambda 4 factorial n, n equals 10, something like that. So that's a huge number downstairs as well.
Yeah,
and there's dimension. So this would be, in 1 plus 1, this would have dimension, so I would divide by m squared. But in 3 plus 1, you would have something similar parameters. And we always have this convention here.
So lambda is 30.
Yeah, lambda is 30.
The whole parameter is what?
No, so that's why I said...
Oh, sorry, 0.1?
What then?
The whole thing is 0.1. Lambda 30, downstairs there is again 24,
yeah,
and there's another factor of 10.
So the good question to ask,
is lambda m.
No, the good question to ask.
Not lambda over m.
No, lambda over n is not the expansion parameter.
Yeah, the pi is lambda, so
you should not think of lambda over n as being the expansion parameter. No. It's a 1 over n expansion. We calculate critical exponents from this, for instance.
So,
but it's not that it's an expansion in coupling.
But the good way to answer this question actually is to look at the spectral density and see whether this quasi particle is fairly narrow or whether it's very broad.
And that's and 1 over n.
And 1 over n, if you increase n, it becomes narrower and narrower.
Yeah.
One over n. But also in the loop expansion, if you increase lambda, it becomes wider. If you decrease lambda, it becomes smaller. Mm-hmm. But whether the absolute value of 30 means it's large or not, that depends on a better way to look at, see if it's very broad or very, very narrow. I think that's the...
Now, shouldn't this theory have bound states? If I crank up lambda? I mean, I just have particles with attracted contact interactions?
I track lambda's positive.
Oh, sorry, wait a minute. Yes, excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Depends what theory you're doing. This is results just for pi 4.
Yeah, he didn't show you Kava so far.
So far, you just showed pi 4 and 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1.
And I think you didn't even show 3 plus 1.
No, but the results look very similar, isn't it? But I didn't do 3 plus 1, so I don't know. I didn't do it. But the fermions have only been done in 3 plus 1.
Fermions?
Your Kalman model. Yeah.
Large general.
Yeah, we also use the 1 over n next to the
and
3 plus 1. 3 plus 1. I'm not sure about the large n actually, because the coupling, this coupling is specific for a 4 scale field.
So the, if you use it, for those things he showed, it didn't matter if you use a loop expansion or 1 over n. But for instance, in applications of inflationary universe dynamics, where you have instabilities and occupation numbers growing to occupation numbers of order 1 over the self-coupling, so when it becomes really, truly non-perturbative, then it was crucial, for instance, to use the 1 over n expansion. But otherwise, those results you saw do not really depend on the approximation.
So for preheating applications, I think so.
Did you try anything with just the fun with
the yeah, people have done it as well. So tachyonic potential in 3 plus 1 dimensions has been done. Yeah.
Smith from Amsterdam, who used the same techniques for tachyonic.
Yeah, double well potential.
There you have, of course, Massless mode.
Yeah, and you see that as well. So they did...
They helped
with them with the quantity is very similar.
All instabilities... like, for instance, this potential with a negative curvature, all instabilities speed up some of the evolution. But the upshot was that whenever you have an instability, it's exponential in time, it's very quick, but it leads you to something very non-thermal, and then gets very slow.
Then you have a quick response.
Then it's very slow, and actually the interesting part is that we see the same if we look at gauge field theories doing classical statistical simulations after having a plasma instability. Also, correlations grow exponentially. You have a very quick build-up of pressure, but it's far from thermal, and then gets slow. So much of this, what we did in scalar theories, at least qualitatively, you find again when you do pure gauge theories, apart from a collision. Classical statistical simulation.
So shall we have a short break? So if people want, we hear that like another maybe 20 minutes or so, 15, 20 minutes.
The cake time made of cookies is about 3 minutes.
Very short.
Consistently, and maybe I get something like this. And this is the distribution of bare neutrons inside the dressed neutron. Okay, for example, a dressed fermion, a bare fermion inside the, because the trick is that this is the missing measure. Okay? And now,
we just think how to, I don't know if it's clever, okay. But we will have another part of Gert's lecture. Shall we have a discussion afterwards, or shall we do it now? since many of us, I think, missed the starting point of your discussion.
No, this was, I was one for point making that this is the issue of this is a mean field theory in the sense that Self-energy depends on something which is average over this, over the different possibilities for the system.
But you see, as you say it, it could be a statement of an exact, not any approximation. If you write down a Schwinger-Dyson equation, you would have this.
No, but, yeah, but this is no. You can go and play with the Schwinger-Dyson. The problem is when you make a Dyson equation. Dyson equation is okay, but after you approximate this, the self-energy is not anymore.
But until you say what sigma is, you're having.
Okay, sigma is the self-energy.
I know it's different, but until you say what functional form it has,
yes,
you're having.
And you haven't done
some functional form, which is right. So, I mean, it's
right.
Not wrong.
But the right form is infinite.
No, I think you just use the language of G.
A function
is
of G.
No,
but that's an exact statement.
Lots of things, but it's a mother and some other things.
It's not the function of G.
We can talk about it afterwards, because there is a limitation by considering only G if you do a truncation. It will come up in my discussion.
Okay, but the other issue is of this, okay, which is of the renormalization of the densities. So I can solve it in vacuum, and I'll have a density of bare fermion inside the dress fermion. Okay, then I go to the medium, and then there are other fermions around. And even without considering any interactions between them, the fermions were, for example, Pauli block the recoil. Okay, and in fact, if I make it very dense, then this fermion cannot recoil inside the medium anymore because these intermediate states are blocked. So actually, the momentum distribution now of a bare fermion inside a dressed fermion in the matter will become closer to this kind of.
Okay. I think that's all included somehow.
I know that it's all included, but the point is wrong.
So the fact is that you call this a bare fermion,
yes,
and a medium effect,
yes,
and then all the ones, those equations kind of sum all of that up.
I know that they sort of, but then I ask a question, what is the distribution of fermions, or dressed fermions inside the matter?
Yeah, so you can look at what the quasi-particle spectral function is, see where it, what the mass is, what is with it, and then you can look at occupation.
So I look at it in terms of bare quantities,
but you only have 2 points from
it. There are no bare quantities after remember.
There are no bare quantities.
G naught is the first.
Yes.
G naught is the bare, but that's not what you look at.
You see,
that's the differential.
Differential operator, yes. Yeah. That's.
So if I look, let's say you look, okay. If you look at zero temperature nuclear matter, and you look at the distribution of bare nucleons inside in nuclear matter, this will be your two-point function. Okay, I'll have an occupation which is something like this.
But you're really
okay, and this is some kind of tiniest.
You're basically thinking of a non-relativistic system where the number of particles is conserved.
I chose the new color here. Okay, that's fine.
So I guess I will continue writing on the deck.
So this will be hopefully like 20 minutes or less. Never know. So I want to do another precision test, which has to do with the lake Agilibush. So what happens at very late times? Well, we had two talks yesterday and the day before. What happens at late times? The system should evolve hydrodynamically. And hydrodynamics is characterized by the transport coefficients. And so we should, within the 2PI framework, see what we get for transport coefficients in order to make a quantitative statement about the evolution at late times. Now, since we have an effect action and a functional method that all works very nicely, because what we need for transport coefficients are correlation functions, but these are composite operators, say for the conductivity it would be this, or for shear viscosity for a scalar field it would be V1 phi, V2 phi, but energy tensor, And so we have we need to compute a two-point function of composite operators, so something that looks like this. But these are these currents that you watch relax in the Kubo. So we're gonna, so I should say the, what we use here now, the Kubo formal linear response framework, so we can analyze the problem in equilibrium and compute current correlators in equilibrium and extract from this the transfer coefficient T1. So I'm not going to solve the non-equilibrium problem and look at the very late time evolution in order to extract transfer coefficient. I'm going to use the Kubo relation and linear response in order to say that I can do an equilibrium calculation, but then extract the transfer coefficient from that calculation.
How good is this for non-equilibrium?
Say again?
How good is this?
Well, for non-equilibrium, you actually follow the energy momentum tensor to very late time and see how it relaxes towards the equilibrium value.
And if it doesn't?
If it doesn't.
Is that proportional value still to compute the coefficient, transport coefficient?
So I think a system that expands, continues expanding, you're always a force to draw
it. Okay, then.
But if you're never in equilibrium,
yeah. If you're never in equilibrium, you wouldn't use that framework,
I guess. Yeah, I guess it's.
Yeah. But in two sentences, Kubo relations are just a framework that says I want to compute that transfer coefficient and I don't really care where I want to apply it to, whether I want to apply it to this particular physical situation or that particular physical situation. I just want to know that a characteristic of the system. It's like how I want to know, say, the pressure as a function of energy, independent of whether I apply it in cosmology or in physics. The same thing, I want to know what are the shear viscosity, what are the conductivity, you know, to a sign. So we compute these equilibrium correlation functions of composite operators, so they have this form. Now, since we have a functional framework, Fukuyama effect of action, actually not only the two-point function is defined by the Dyson equation, but also higher-point functions are defined. So there is an integral equation. So if you derive an equation, you can derive an equation for a two-point function like this, then type, and you find that it takes this form, and then you tie these two guys together. And this block that appears in here obeys an integral equation. And so this is a ladder type equation, which when you close the ends, you will compute that correlator, but when you solve it iteratively, you see that you will construct this typical ladder form in Feynman diagrams.
The track is a full propagator?
Sorry, so this is still to be determined. So this is the kernel, the ROM here. And that is, again, it's fixed by gamma 2pi. And so we start from exactly the same action as before, same truncation. And it turns out that this ROM, lambda, is given by the derivative of the self energy with respect to d, or in other words, the second derivative of gamma 2 with respect to d squared. And so given your effective action, given your truncation, everything is again fixed, and you see what happens. So if I take an expansion where I have these disks, this three-loop diagram, the self energy will be the setting sum, and the kernel in the integral equation will be just this particular four-point function. If I have a three-loop diagram like this, then the self energy, this diagram, and the kernel in the integral equation, the kernel that looks like this. This is of course wrong. I was wondering how it works. But if I cut one more line, I guess of course this. And so I generate ladder diagrams. So this will give these ladder diagrams of this type, which we all know. And here it's a little bit more complicated because here we, if I just, well, it's not more complicated, but if I just would use this ROM and look at the diagrams and work out the kinematics, it would turn out you get zero. So you have to use the fact that these are full propagators and iterate it one time in this direction, so you get this ROM, and also iterate it once in the in this direction, so you get this particular kernel in your integral equation. So this is after iteration.
And it's by Q plus by 4, there's a slew more.
There's a whole set of mixed things. And so so given your truncation, you know now what kind of level diagrams are resolved. And I won't go into the physics, but it turns out that for transport coefficients, it's indeed needed to resolve the infinite set of level diagrams because our specific kinematical configuration where these propagators share the same momentum and same energy, so that's something called pinching poles, which leads to an artificial enhancement, and all of these diagrams have to be resolved. So this is the correct set of diagrams, or the structure of the diagrams that you need and that you expect. So we can say something very precise now. So in lambda 5-4, if we include just this diagram, we will resolve precisely those nanodiagrams up here. And that means then if you look at, say, the paper by Fionn, that we will get the shear viscosity correct to a leading order in decoupling.
But not bulk viscosity.
But not bulk viscosity, because for bulk viscosity, you need this particular diagram. And that has not been included, so bulk viscosity is not included correctly.
But what is interesting from this three-loop diagram, you also get contributions to bulk viscosity.
You get a part of bulk viscosity because it's off-shell and play a part of the computation process.
What is interesting is, whenever we compared evolutions to, you know, with rather high occupation numbers, to simulations from classical statistical field theory, it compared very well, even though we didn't have bulk viscosity determinatively included. And in 1 plus 1, it's bulk viscosity that does the thermalization. Because you need the particle number changing processes. So we were puzzled that in 1 plus 1, we were quantitatively correct by just following a loop expansion, PPI, even though the perturbative argument would have told you, oh, you missed it completely.
That's right. So you have parametrically, at recoupling you will be wrong, but you have a lot of physics in there because the fact that these propagators are not perturbative propagators, but a lot of things to resolve. So that's a good point. Then we have the 1 over n expansion, the next leading order, that this particular diagram. And so the kernel that appears in the integral equation in this case is a kernel like this and a kernel like this. So in this case, there are two coupled equations because there's an auxiliary field propagator and there's a propagator of the field itself. When you combine those two equations, you find these two runs in your integral equation. And these are precisely the ones that you need to get, say, the shear viscosity correct in leading order 1 over n expansion. But the coupling is not constrained to be recoupling, of course. So it can be arbitrary up to the lambda pole and so on. But you get the correct leading order result in 1 over n expansion. And then the last case, so now I will say something about gate theories. So the last example is say QED, where we have this diagram. So again, the kernel here looks similar to the auxiliary field formalism, exactly the same structure. And if you again iterate it, in fact, you get a bunch of coupled equations like before. But if I iterate them all to one loop,
So, one second, QED. There's no one over N, but this is a...
It will be large enough, for instance.
It will be large enough, so...
I'll come to that.
Which, if it's weakly coupled, has a reasonable dynamic range before you run into the lambda pole. If it's strongly coupled, then you're sort of squished to nothing.
So, what is this? Can you write down any, do you have any analytic expressions or?
No. So typically, well, you have an expression in the sense that the shear viscosity is T cube over lambda squared with some number here, and that would be a recoupling result. In the OM model, you cannot write it down. The shear viscosity would be T cube times N squared, and then there's some function which depends on the lambda and on the mass. Okay. And that function, at recoupling, of course, this function goes to 1 over lambda squared, but for arbitrary lambda, there's no analytic, there's some curve.
For some, there's also dependence on the
curve. Well, this theory has also a lambda pole. Yeah. And so so you renormalize it, then you find the beta function, you find that the lambda pole, and that we did actually in detail. So
the lambda there is a function of what?
So the lambda runs, but it appears in a combination which is a reversible variable. That I can show you quickly, but it...
So it's not...
This quantity here is... No, it appears precisely in a combination with... if I remember, I mean, it appears in a combination with that here, but the combination is such that it's invariant. It's essentially all what enters there is a one loop calculation because that's the level where you have to go to, and we work out in detail in the paper.
So that just amounts to saying you can regard it as lambda evaluating the scale of t,
yeah,
or m as you prefer.
Yeah. Actually, before going to before going to QED, let's go to cubic and quartic interaction, because there's something slightly interesting. Namely, that if I have only cubic interaction and I do two loop, so then I have these two rungs in the theory. And in order to make contact with kinetic theory, I have to cut these rungs, and that will tell me what the scattering processes are. So these are square of scattering of matrix elements, and so what I have here is actually the sum of the scattering in the T channel, if I just schematically write it like this, plus the sum plus the square of the scattering in the S channel. So if I use say kinetic theory and I want to use a particular matrix, I want to use this matrix element square in the U channel, so I have these scattering processes here, like this, so without interference, if I restrict myself to the two-loop approximation. If I now include the three-loop approximation, and I include all these diagrams which I had before, I have a whole bunch of kernels more, and so I have this one, for instance, which is just lambda squared, but I also have diagrams like this, and diagrams like this. And all of these now, if I cut those, are interference. So this is an interference, say, between T channel and a four point vertex. And this is interference, say, between T channel and S channel, like this. And so when I do the, don't do the two loop approximation, but I do the three loop approximation, then the matrix element that appears is actually now the sum of the scattering So it should be z squared, and then s plus c plus u squared. And so restricting to the two-loop approximation gives you the sum of the scattering processes, whereas the three-loop gives you the square of the sum of processes. And so you get the complete 2-to-2 scattering. But you need to go to three-loop for that. So now QED, so there we have only look at this two-loop diagram for the moment. And so if I write down all one-loop kernels, this one.
How do you preserve the
In the applications, you choose the gauge. But in the application to transfer coefficients, where you can work out analytically, you can show that since the gauge parameter drops out actually, because all the particles. All the fermions essentially are put on shell,
But what you're describing is working hard to reproduce results you could do much more easily.
I know,
because it's because you're looking at the weakly coupled regime.
If you do kinetic theory, you would just have a few scattering processes that you have to include, and then you do the same. But in kind of the bigger picture of what I said before the break, you can do things beyond kinetic theory.
But then you've got to deal with David's question, right?
Yeah, so that's why we have a virtual.
No, actually, there are partial answers to this. I don't want to say we solved this, but yeah, we will have a session on this. And there we will say more. It's less severe than...
Well, what bothers me is that, you know, you, in the truncation, you're keeping the two-point function. But you're dropping the three-point function,
right.
And they're related by word.
Right. Yeah.
So it seems inconsistent unless you say, well, this is a good approximation in some gauge, which makes it all an absolute gauge invariant, but then dependent on what you think is the right gauge. So there might be a resolution, say, I will adopt this non-gauge invariant scheme in lambda with confinement gauge because I like that kind of propagator.
In principle, you're right, but the problem is that everybody has been saying this for a long time already.
The interesting thing is, for instance, you could say these things already for scalar theories.
Sure.
You could ask, for instance, do you have Goldstone boson? Do you have the what identity there?
Gauge invariance is a different story.
Yeah, but you see, there is already an issue in scalar theory.
There are analogous things.
There's an analogous thing.
Quite easily.
Yes, and actually, if you look at it, you do. And now,
if you do an approximation that doesn't respect the continuous symmetry, mm-hmm. there are times you could, your approximation scheme could break symmetry, other symmetries. Real symmetries.
Everything what he wrote down so far.
Yeah.
In the broken phase, would apparently violate Goldstone theory.
The broken phase.
Just a pure scalar theory.
Pure scalar theory in the broken phase.
A U1 scalar theory.
Or OM.
Okay.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you now compute physical quantities.
It's not obvious to me what you're saying is correct. One of M extensions don't violate the OM symmetry.
If you do the 2pi version of this, which is not the standard one, or it does.
It's not a real one-over-n expansion.
But the real one-over-n expansion would break down very quickly because you need to resum to get the leading order, for instance, viscosities,
So any perturbative description, or any one-of-rain description...
This is systematic one-of-rain expansion.
Yeah, but this is secular in time.
Because it doesn't sum up the secular effects which allow you to see the long-term.
So it's non-uniform in time. So a small expansion parameter at some time is not a small expansion parameter at another time.
It's not uniform in time.
And to be honest, it's uniform in time.
The leading one-of-rain is okay.
It's okay.
But nobody has a way of doing that.
No, this
a systematic. If you have a systematic expansion, you could, by systematic, I mean something which would preserve symmetries. But nobody's found a way of preserving the O-N symmetry and doing a systematic.
Should I say something to this?
Well, maybe I will finish this, because then I can sit down.
Let me finish the transport bit.
For the scalar case, you can get a nice answer.
Yeah. So in QED, if you go to one loop, you get these particular rungs, and here the point is then, again, so these two will dominate in these two dominate in decoupling, and so give you the correct transport coefficient to a leading log approximation, and the other ones are subleading. So you know that in this two-loop approximation, leading log will be fine, but not beyond. And in large NF, it's slightly different. In large NF, it's number one and number four. Number four, this one. These two are the ones that dominate in large NF, and so you get the correct transport coefficient at leading order in 1 over NF, and the other ones are subleading. And so you know that if you solve that truncation self-consistently out of equilibrium, you will at least get these transport coefficients correctly, parametrically, but anything else subleading you don't have. So there's one improvement on that. If you want to go to full leading order in gauge theories, you have to resolve a whole additional class of diagrams. So this is leading order gauge theories. You have to take all 2-to-2 scattering, but you also have to take Bernstein or particle number changing processes. So you have to ask Larry about that. And if you want to implement those scattering processes, 2pi is not sufficient, but you have to go to the 3pi effective action, and Mac knows about that. And in that case, you have two equations, one equation for the two-point function, but also an equation for the three-point function, and those set of equations combine some precisely the class of diagrams you need to describe gauge theory correctly at leading order. So that's the status with respect to transport coefficients and the connection with hydrodynamics and transport coefficients, which have been known from kinetic theory from another source, that you can reproduce using these effective action techniques in this way.
So the examples you talked about, well, first of all, let me say, I mean, focusing on transport coefficients is arguably unfair from the perspective of 2PI or MPI methods in general, which can let you ask lots of different questions. But having focused on transport coefficients, the examples you told us about are examples where there is a good quasi-particle description, and therefore you're justified in using kinetic theory, which does give you the right answer. Are there cases where you want to argue that this is reliable, where I can't do it from kinetic theory?
Can you get 1 over 4 pi?
Oh, no, so you cannot get 1 over 4 pi because within these classes of diagrams that you resum, you're always essentially resumming certain scattering.
No, but even more importantly, you haven't done non-abelian
yet.
Larry, take the examples in 1 plus 1 or 3 plus 1 for scalar theories.
For transport coefficients,
if you stay within the question of thermal equilibrium, in arbitrarily weak coupling.
No, there are lots of other questions we could be discussing, but Eric was focusing on transport coefficients.
But you were asking for precision tests, and that's why you did that.
Yeah,
suppose we discuss 2 plus 1 dimensions. There, the Kubo formulas tell you to take a limit that doesn't actually exist. Transport coefficients actually have logarithmic length. What does it take to see that in this framework?
That's a good question. We should be able to work it out, I guess. But yeah.
If you're trying to measure the viscosity in an experiment, because of basically non-linearities of hydrodynamic modes coupled to themselves, that it's never correctly given by a linearized description on arbitrarily long length scales.
Must be worse than 1 plus 1.
Yes. And there's even crazier. Yeah.
And you gain the success of the method in 1 plus 1.
No, I mean, to say that here you at least see physics that truly looks like thermalization in a variety of examples, I give you a lot of credit for that. That's real.
All he's saying is that this matches on near equilibrium to the standard.
That's the point.
Okay, but
it may not be in practice, but it gives a benchmark of things that are known and that have been computed before using a different language, mm-hmm. and this is consistent with that. It also shows a limitation in some sense because it tells you that both viscosity is not included, or if you don't do this, you don't include LPM effect. So it tells you what
the stage theory is. The other method can stage invariant. Mm-hmm.
Whereas this method, but it's limited to a domain of weak coupling.
Yeah,
you have narrow particles.
But the point is that weak coupling, of course, they're all the same. And weak coupling, this NPI, is as good as kinetic theory. It's as gauge invariant as kinetic theory because all these terms.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah,
weak coupling is.
You're not.
You can strictly, if you have weak coupling, you can show that those terms that bother you are higher order than coupling.
That has been shown. That's
a
press.
It's a rigorous proof.
And not a linear theory.
As well.
Yeah.
No, yes, of course.
It's a paper by Jan Smith.
Yeah. No, that's a trivial thing. It's really everything that bothers you is higher order in coupling or higher order in 1 over n. So only if you ask for strong coupling properties, you may say there is an issue about gauge invariance.
Right.
Because the diagram, I don't see here.
So let me give you an example.
It's not obvious at all to me why Hayden Banks is the even over the.
I think I can show examples where this will produce gauge-dependent results.
At weak coupling, we always recover Boltzmann or kinetic theory results, rigorously. And
in these examples, we've done the calculation QD in a generalized Coulomb gauge with a gauge parameter, and you can show explicitly that it drops out.
For what? For the transport?
For the transport coefficient.
Well, that could be.
Yeah.
But that's more than just recoupling. That's saying
pieces of these diagrams
are actually
going to the momentum limit.
Sort of because you're on shell.
Yes. It's going to go on shell.
Yeah,
right.
But these equations are certainly
are general. That's right.
Are not going to be changing very much for recoupling.
Right.
Correct.
But it also shows that it's suppressed if you go off shell, but you look at this, it's not columns, it's suppressed.
Well,
the gauge parameter vanishes in the strict limit where you're interested in the potential.
Thermalization is the current actually pressure off shell for weak coupling, right?
Yeah, but you see, now we have to really focus on what
dimension dependent in a sense. Yeah. That was a big issue of 1 plus 1, but now it's 3 plus 1.
No, but I mean, he's right. I mean, in 1 plus 1 it was a big issue, and that's because of off shell effects. But for those.
But the answer about the gauge invariance, as far as I understand, is that this is a problem you're stuck with.
But only at not weak coupling. If you go to strictly weak coupling limit?
Weak coupling.
No, if you have weak coupling and you're far from equilibrium and look at not just the long distance modes, you will still have gauge invariance problems. in general.
Not for the transport coupling.
Not for the transport couplers, but these equations are not getting there.
Yeah, but is it true for some physical quantity?
For some quantities, it's insensitive to that.
A physical quantity?
Yeah.
Like the viscosity. So.
No, you're saying is there a gauge-dependent problem of recoupling for a physical quantity?
I think so.
Sure.
You're going to have those distribution functions far from equilibrium before you go on shell when that gauge invariant, period.
I agree with what Jurgen said, that the gauge invariance is always going to be suppressed in the coupling as long as you're recoupling.
No. It's not just weak coupling. It depends on the state and what quantity you look at. It's not uniform and weak coupling. The equations by construction are not
I'm not even charging you by the initial conditions are not gauge.
I mean, that thing
is not Hilbert theory.
In the initial condition, is what you would put in. Yes.
You call a Gaussian initial condition in one gauge is going to be non-Gaussian to someone else, isn't it?
But the same problem you have in a Boltzmann equation where you restrict yourself to Gaussian physics. Boltzmann equation just has particle number. Particle number is obtained from 2.5.
It's okay for an Abelian theory, but not Abelian theory, Gaussian, you know, is not just quadratic in the field. B squared, the vacuum so, functional.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this theory is without problems for non-Abelian gauge theories. I'm just saying if you go to the strict recoupling limit, of course we recover standard Abelian theory and resum
the Abelian theory. In the strict recoupling limit, you have non-interacting vectors.
No, I mean in the sense of a Boltzmann equation.
Yeah,
no.
Sorry?
So if you, what Larry was saying is, why do we use this and not the kinetic restriction? And I'm just pointing out that in the strict recoupling, this is the kinetic description.
Okay, but Engel made a strong statement.
Yes, I know. We have to look at that.
If you formulate gauge invariant questions,
you're talking about the
far from equilibrium. Yeah, even in
strict recoupling,
those equations, 2pi,
they're not.
You concentrate on what? The electrons or the.
Those quantities are
those quantities the self and say the electrons.
So anyway, I would like to see that. So the strict recoupling limit.
Well, what about the boson? The photons?
What about the boson distributions as well?
The photons have the same problem? There's a difference. One is the charged particles.
Yes.
The other are the neutral particles.
And are you thinking
of the charged particles?
Are you thinking of NPI or of some variant?
Well, I know that these equations are not gauge invariant. They do not respect the Laurier generals. I'm sure I can construct quantities which are gauge parameter dependent.
But the question is whether, in QED, no matter what you do, there are lots of quantities that are gauge dependent.
Yeah, but here,
even if you do things correctly, but they're not physical, so you have to ask.
No, but these quantities if you look at distribution functions, there are quantities that you would expect to be gauge invariant that are not.
Try to be careful with charged particles,
sure.
Because some of their properties are gauge dependent.
Sure, absolutely. So you can look at
properties.
Well, for example, you can look at the. You can look at the decay rates. You can look at the spectral widths.
The spectral widths are gauge. I mean, that's all. The property itself.
No, but the inverse property here, the position of the pole, and those things should be gauge invariant.
The position of the pole.
The position of the pole is.
Yes.
But it is tricky. I agree. It's
going to get dark. A number of people said, just for sorry, a number of people said that I should go. Those people don't want to miss it. So Mac, for instance, asked, is there another discussion on this? And I would say, yes, we should have another discussion.
We should pick up things and have.
And maybe you also make your point, which I would be very interested in understanding in detail.
All right. Let's
schedule another meeting that not some of us miss this, I think, very important topic. So let's thank you again.
another time about it.